The Will to Resist.
And he said, look, I come back and all I can think about is a rock. I can't get it out of my head. I go sit in class and my head's in a rock. And I go to my job and my head's in a rock. And I can't get any relief from it. And I'm grinding my teeth at night when I sleep. I'm having nightmares. And he said, sometimes I even do things that aren't like myself at all.
That's Dar Jamail. We'll talk with him about how the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are affecting veterans and how they're fighting back.
You were sitting out on the deck and she pops some in her mouth and she takes the seeds and she flings them over her shoulder into the yard and she says, well, you'll have an olive tree any day now.
There is a question of the orderly world being completely disrupted and overturned, and the detective goes through and applies logic and brings the world back to order.
Those were mystery novelist Lisa Kleinholz and cookbook author Laura Brody. We'll talk with them and blogger B.J. Roche. They're all panelists on the upcoming Right Angles Writers Conference taking place November 21st at Mount Holyoke College. Army psychiatrist Nidal Hassan was about to be deployed to Iraq when he took the lives of 13 people at Fort Hood earlier this month. He'd seen the effects of the war firsthand, counseling veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder. Rather than go to Iraq, he planned to die along with those he murdered. Though some suspect a Muslim extremist motive for the shootings, it's telling that 18 U.S. war veterans commit suicide every day. The toll is even higher for veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan. Dar Jamail's first book, Beyond the Green Zone, looked at the devastation of the war in Iraq on civilians. Now this unembedded journalist has come out with The Will to Resist. The book is about how the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are affecting veterans who've come back home. They suffer from PTSD from battle, but also sexual violence against women soldiers, the failures of the veteran system, and continual redeployments. As a result, Jamail says more soldiers are dying by suicide than are killed in combat. Some soldiers are fighting back, not through violence, but political resistance, informing their fellow soldiers, and even fleeing the country. They're also trying to make sure that other troops don't have to go through what they did. Dar Jamail writes of their courageous opposition to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The Will to Resist gives us insight into how the horrors of war can affect the human soul. Dar Jamail, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
The Will to Resist, this is your second book. You started out your career in journalism by just basically picking up and going to Iraq and blogging about it. We spoke to you several years ago about your first book, Beyond the Green Zone. That book looked at the impact of the American occupation on the lives of ordinary Iraqi civilians. This one is a very different book. Here you're really giving voice to U.S. soldiers. How did you make the shift from reporting from the former perspective to the latter?
It was really a natural process, but one that kind of just happened to me as opposed to one that I sought out. I was actually on tour for the first book, Beyond the Green Zone, and when I was giving talks across the country, I started running into Iraq War veterans, and they were telling me about some rather surprising stories about how morale was extremely low in Iraq, and then that they were actually disgruntled enough that they started doing things to resist their orders and really doing whatever they could to kind of resist direct participation in the occupation. For example, I ran into a Army colonel who was active duty at the time, a man named Phil Aliff, and I was up in upstate New York nearby Fort Drum, where he was based out of, and he said, oh yes, morale was very, very low when we were over there. In fact, we decided that we would quit doing patrols, but we would do it in a covert way, such as running our patrol out to the end of the patrol route, finding a big open field, parking our Humvees, and then calling into base every hour and saying, yes, we're still searching the field for weapons caches. We'll call you back in about an hour. And I was really surprised at this, and I asked him, well, how often were you doing this? And he said, well, we were doing it every other day, and you know, I knew tons of other people over there who were doing the same thing. And as I continued to go around giving talks, I was meeting more and more veterans and hearing very similar stories. And kind of the deeper I dug, the more I was finding. And so I realized, wow, there might actually be enough material here for a book.
Do you think that this is all that much different than, you know, what soldiers might do in any war, or is there something different about this one?
Well, I think there's both similarities and differences. I mean, for sure, in all wars, you're going to have a situation where that pushes soldiers up against their real morality and mortality. And so, you know, kind of that old saying of there are no atheists in foxholes, where, you know, when people are getting on a plane and know that they're literally about to be sent over into a combat zone and have no idea what's going to happen to them as a result, it really forces them up against their decisions. And do I really believe in this? Am I really willing to die for this? Am I really willing to risk what I'm about to do? And it really kind of creates this moral crisis point. And I think that's common in all wars. But I think what's different now, especially when we look back to, you know, so-called just wars like World War II, when the difference now is that when soldiers are looking at Iraq and Afghanistan, and this is what I heard from them when I was working on my book and what I'm hearing from them as I continue to work on articles today, and that's that, look, you know, it's extremely demoralizing to someone in the military to look at both of these and see very clearly that there's no end line. There's no real withdrawal date. There's nothing to show me as a soldier that if I deploy over there, that I know, worst case scenario, I won't be over there more than 6 months or a year, because then this thing's going to be wrapped up. And there's no definitive guidelines to really measure progress and success. So I think that's really exacerbating the situation now when soldiers are asked to deploy over to these occupations. I think it's making them ask more questions.
This is also a different kind of army, for example, than the one in Vietnam. That was a drafted army. This is a volunteer army. Are there any differences related to that in terms of the kind of the developing will to resist in these soldiers?
Yes, that's actually, I would think, the prime factor in why we have such a different situation today as we did in Vietnam. Since we have an all-volunteer force, and you know, that obviously is going to be causing overall less resistance and certainly less organized resistance. But we have to keep in mind that the all-volunteer force was created as a result of the disaster that was created by the draft for the military. And that was a massive organized GI resistance movement during Vietnam that really was a key component in bringing that war to an end. And, you know, if something like that were to happen today, I think we'd be looking at a very different situation. But what's happened then, instead of an overt draft, we do have, however, a poverty draft where more and more people are joining the military, especially amidst this ongoing economic crisis besetting the country, that they join because in so many cases it's the last house on the block for them to find a job. Of course, then we have the recruiters going around basically telling people whatever they want to hear to get them to sign on the dotted line. And so that is not exactly helping the unity and the integrity of the U.S. military when they're taking basically anyone that will join. At this point, they've lowered their standards enough to where, the base requirement to join the military is, do you have a pulse? They're taking convicted rapists, convicted felons. The Army has over 8,000 people in it now with rap sheets. They're taking white supremacists. It's really quite a devastating situation where this isn't helping the military's cause, and all of this adds up to a situation where more and more people are starting to resist what's happening.
And what is the impact of bringing, you know, kind of letting down the standards on the overall morale of the troops?
Well, it's all of that factors in, coupled with another extremely important factor, and this is not certainly not lost to people in the military, is what we've all been hearing over the last months/years, which is soldiers come home and, you know, there's this thing called stop loss, where they might finish a contract and then the military can say, look, you know, you're about to finish, but because we're in a state of emergency in this country, because of these two wars, we can actually send you back for another deployment. So sorry about that. And that's extremely demoralizing. And then we have the situation where when soldiers come back and they need post-traumatic stress disorder treatment, they need trauma treatment, they need different types of treatment for the injuries they suffered in Iraq or Afghanistan, and the average wait for a soldier to get a VA treatment appointment is 6 months. And so there's that situation. Then there's the military doing things like not diagnosing people so that they don't have to treat them in the VA, or to not diagnose them so that they can actually keep them in the military and redeploy them. We've had 43,000 soldiers diagnosed with either post-traumatic stress disorder or traumatic brain injury who have been redeployed to one of these occupations. All of this factors in to really send a strong message to soldiers that, look, you're not going to be taken care of. If you go over to these places and something horrible happens to you, the odds of you coming home and actually getting the treatment that the country is certainly relegated to give you are quite low. And there are just one horror story after another of soldiers coming back and not getting their treatment and ending up literally homeless and families being put into crisis because of it. And certainly all of this is circulating around the ranks of the military, and that is unquestionably a severe blow to morale as well.
You actually have an incredible figure in your book, The Will to Resist. You say 1,000 vets who are in the care of the VA are attempting suicide every month, and 18 of them die. You call it a kind of resistance of desperation.
It really is, and this is another really important statistic. If someone wants to really understand what impact are both these ongoing endless occupations having on the military, it's really devastating the military. You know, people not getting this treatment, and they're coming home, and they can't get out, and they feel so desperate that, you know, they're in so much pain because of post-traumatic stress disorder and severe depression and other problems. When they feel that the last resort they have is to literally kill themselves to get relief from the pain. You know, as you said, 1,000 a month, veterans a month are attempting suicide. 18 a day are successfully killing themselves. 18. More people are killing themselves by suicide at home than are being killed in combat overseas on any given day. It's really completely out of control. And then to underscore that fact, in 2007, the Army had a record number of suicides, and that was the most suicides they'd had since they began keeping records in 1980. In 2008, there was another record set surpassing 2007. And then right now, this year, we're on track to set yet another grim record. And I think this is a very clear indicator of the cost on the military that both these occupations are having.
Now, I just want to get something right. You said 18 a day or 18 a month?
18 a day in this country from all wars, not just Iraq and Afghanistan, but veterans of all wars who are attempting suicide, 18 a day are killing themselves.
Wow. And why do you feel that it is so much more? I mean, after all, Vietnam was a pretty brutal conflict. World War II, there was, in fact, casualties were higher in theater itself, I think, certainly with World War II and also with Vietnam, in terms of at least deaths. Why do you think this war different in some way? What are the demons that are afflicting these soldiers to the extent that they are trying to kill themselves?
Well, one factor is that it is true to say that there is a very high likelihood now, because of advances in medical technology as well as the military's ability to use aircraft and other means to get severely wounded soldiers out of the war zone and into a very advanced medical care unit in a very, very short amount of time. So, you know, for example, if you were a soldier in World War II and got wounded, for every wounded soldier, there was a dead soldier. There was that kind of ratio because, you know, if you got wounded and you were out in the middle of nowhere during World War II, odds are you weren't going to be saved. And compared to today, I think the statistic is 9 wounded to 1 dead. And that's indicative of the fact that, you know, we're able with medical technology today to, if someone has severe trauma, like both legs being blown off in a roadside bomb and this kind of thing, they're still able to save these people's lives. But that that's the good news, but the bad news is that translates to a massive number of seriously wounded people, both psychologically, physically, or both, that are coming back home. I mean, the military, there's so many wounded in Iraq alone, for example, that they, when they started reaching the 30,000 mark of wounded soldiers, they realized that wasn't going to look real good in the media, so they started differentiating them and splitting them into 3 different categories. And so now we'll still see like a general category of wounded as being around 32,000, but when we look at all 3 categories together, we're looking at well in excess now of 72,000 soldiers who've been wounded in Iraq. And as I just described, when we say wounded, we're not talking about like a broken arm or some scrapes. We're talking about severely traumatized people who are going to be needing some sort of medical attention for the rest of their lives.
And so those three categories, are they something like, you know, wounded in action, wounded by accident, or how's that breakdown?
Yeah, it's something to that effect. I don't remember off the top of my head, but it's like, you know, combat wounded, non-combat related injuries and sickness. It's something along those lines.
And some of those non-combat injuries that you speak about in your book, The Will to Resist, I was very struck, are with women, a huge proportion of whom are being injured because they're being sexually assaulted.
Yes, this really, for me, was the most difficult chapter in the entire book to write. It's certainly the most brutal chapter for the reader, because it really goes into detail. I include several stories of women who were brutally raped in the military, a couple of them while they were in Iraq, people being raped even when they're stateside, etc. And I want to throw out a couple of figures, because there's, according to the VA, 20% of all the women veterans treated in the VA report having been raped in the military. And then there's another Pentagon report that came out a couple of years ago that shows that 80% of all military sexual assaults do not go unreported. Do not go reported. So when we look at those figures together, I mean, you know, you can kind of, you know, really draw from that we're looking at, basically, if you're a woman and you join the military today, you basically have 100% chance of being either raped or sexually assaulted. And that's exactly what I found when I spoke with women while writing my book, was that, you know, at the very least, they would have extremely lewd comments made to them. Just about all of them knew someone in the military who had been raped if they hadn't been assaulted at some point themselves. And then there's another phenomena that has happened in the military where they call it command rape, where literally higher-ranking soldiers will use their authority as kind of leverage over women that they have power over to then force them to sleep with them, force them to have sex with them. And so, for example, I've heard stories like, if you know, we're out in the field, and if we want our rations and our water on time, then I'm going to have to be doing some favors for my commander.
Yeah, so we should be clear here. These are not rapes that are being committed by Iraqi forces or by the Iraqi resistance.
No, I'm being very specific here. This is a chapter all about rape happening with female soldiers in the military from other U.S. soldiers.
What kind of resistance are women putting up to this?
Well, the upswing or the silver lining to this is that there is a lot of resistance now. More and more women are being very vocal about it. They're speaking up about it. They're talking about it in public. And there was an organization founded by several women who were all victims of military sexual trauma. And the name of the organization is called SWAN, Service Women's Action Network. And they basically exist to help other women in the military come get assistance, learn how they can fight back, learn how they can file charges against their perpetrators. And there was another fine example. You know, there's many women now that have basically taken it to the street, taken it upon themselves to educate other girls who might be considering joining the military, young women. One woman I spoke with who's in the book, for example, her name's Marisa La Guzman, and she lives in the L.A. area, and she told me that one thing she does is to go around and take it upon herself to go into high schools and speak with school kids and let these high school age women know, look, if you're thinking of joining the military, here's what you need to know. And then talking to them about a whole lot of what we've just been talking about right here. And I asked Marisela, well, how many people do you figure that you've spoken with so far? How many young high school age girls? And she said, oh, probably about 30,000 and counting. So obviously there's a big movement, particularly by women from the military, some active duty, some veterans, to take it upon themselves to really try to prevent more women from joining the military and have this happen to them. And, you know, and some of these women, they're not anti-military. I mean, I spoke with women who said, look, I really love the military. It was a high point in my life. And I have a utmost respect for the military. And if this problem could be addressed and handled correctly, and I would know that women could then safely join the military, I'd be all for them joining the military. But until that happens, as April Fitzsimmons, one of the women in the book, told me, she said, until that happens, I'm telling every woman not to join the military.
And if you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Dar Jamail about his second book about the Iraq War. It's called The Will to Resist, and not just Iraq, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. And you detail in the book the different chapters, talk about different forms of resistance. You just referred to April Fitzsimmons, who said that, you know, she loves the military, but not the way it is right now. You talk about a number of soldiers, many of whom joined believing that they were going to do something good for their country. Some of them joined after 9/11, and then they became pretty disenchanted. One in particular really struck me, and that Brian Kassler. Tell us who he was and what did he say?
Brian Kassler was a U.S. Marine. He served a deployment in Iraq. And then he served a deployment in Afghanistan, and then he was sent back over to Iraq for another deployment. And I spoke with him after he'd come home after those three deployments, and he was very much against both occupations, very much against what he was watching his country do. And at first he said, look, I'm struggling. He really spoke very clearly, and I think, and I quoted him at length in the book because I think it gives the reader a very clear idea of how post-traumatic stress disorder affects people. And he said, you know, he's a very, very kind, very intelligent man. And he said, look, I come back and all I can think about is Iraq. I can't get it out of my head. He was in college at the time. And he said, I go sit in class and my head's in Iraq. And I go to my job and my head's in Iraq. And I can't get any relief from it. And I'm grinding my teeth at night when I sleep. I'm having nightmares. And he said things like, look, and it's affecting my relationship. And I know it's my fault, and I can't get this stuff out of my head, and I want it to stop. And he said, sometimes I even do things that aren't like myself at all. That he told me one instance where he'd do things like be driving down the highway and close his eyes for 15 seconds and just seeing if he's going to run into something. I mean, really like a kind of veiled, not so covert attempt at suicide, but somehow miraculously he hadn't gotten into a car crash. But as a result of all that, and as a result of him seeing what his country's doing in both these countries firsthand and witnessing atrocities firsthand, he said, look, I'm vehemently opposed to this. And, you know, it basically the first key ingredient if a soldier wants to get involved in resistance is you have to start thinking for yourself. Because he told me, the second a soldier starts thinking for themselves, then, you know, they've basically started themselves on a path where they're not going to be able to stay in a military that orders you not to think for yourself, that orders you not to question orders, even though in your own uniform code of military justice, you're supposed to not question an unlawful order. So, you know, his experience kind of highlighted these contradictions in the military, and he's since become a very, very vocal advocate against both wars and for GI rights and trying to help other soldiers who are going to stand up and resist.
Another soldier was Liam Madden. What was it that changed him?
Well, he too, you know, and this is really a common theme of everyone that's in the book who actually served tours over in Iraq or Afghanistan has said the same thing. Look, when I went over there and I saw what I was asked to do and I saw what our policy was doing to the country and people of Iraq, I just couldn't do it anymore. And he came back home, and then when he was trying to exercise his free speech rights in protest, and when he was actually technically off duty to go wear his uniform in protest, he started catching flack from the military. And one of the kind of funny stories about Liam Madden is that the military decided to come after him at one point. They sent him threatening letters, and, you know, being someone who doesn't take kindly to being pushed around, he decided to fight back. And he said, look, no, I'm following the rules. I can wear my uniform if I'm off duty and off base. And I mean, he basically forced it to a head by going public with it and actually ended up getting on a lot of different mainstream media. And at the end of the day, it forced the military to back down. And that's a really important lesson, because what I've seen consistently is when soldiers learn their rights and they're smart about how they're going to fight back against the military and get a good civilian lawyer and get some community support and some media attention to their cause and go about it the right way and really follow the rules and how they do it and going up against the system, not only can they really effectively fight back, but sometimes they can even win.
You know, during the Vietnam War, there was the the Winter Soldier hearings. Our own Senator John Kerry was prominent in those. And they were really organized around GIs talking about the atrocities that they had witnessed and in some cases done themselves in the course of prosecuting that war. You talk about that also, the toll that that takes on these soldiers. And there was another Winter Soldier hearings here, but almost nobody outside of the alternative media heard about it.
That's right. It's really astounding to me how the media, the mainstream media in this country, will not cover these. And these are soldiers who are standing up and telling the truth about what they did in Iraq and Afghanistan, what they saw, what they were a party to, really taking a big risk personally and emotionally and standing up and basically laying it out on the line. Many of them even talking about war crimes that they directly engaged in, like killing civilians, detaining people unlawfully, sometimes abusing and torturing people, and telling this to the public, to anyone who would hear, to try to show people, look, this is the result of U.S. foreign policy, and this is just one method. This is their way to resist both what's happening and to kind of reclaim their own humanity by coming back home, getting very honest with themselves and their peers and the country about this is what's happened, and this is what we're doing, and this is what it's doing to us, and this is what it's doing to people abroad, and this is what it's doing to the reputation of the United States. And, you know, really, when these soldiers do that, I really have utmost respect for their courage and their integrity, because, you know, when a soldier swears an oath, when they become a soldier, they swear an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. And that means, as I said before, under the Uniform Code of Military Justice in the military, that they are not allowed to follow an illegal order, that that is the oath they swear to. And when we look at these situations in Iraq and Afghanistan, I mean, it's very clear to everybody that, look, Iraq violated international law, you know, an act of aggression against a sovereign country. But also, what more and more of these soldiers are starting to talk about is that Afghanistan is also an illegal invasion and occupation. And it is. If you look at international law under the UN Charter, of which the United States is a signatory nation, there are only two reasons to justify a country going to war. One, in self-defense, and two, with UN Security Council ratification. Neither of these was the case with Afghanistan. People said, well, that's self-defense, right, because of 9/11. And you know, the rebut is no, it's not, because it wasn't the nation of Afghanistan that did that, and it certainly wasn't the people of Afghanistan. For example, if al-Qaeda were based in Canada and carried out those attacks, it's not likely that the U.S. would have bombed Canada to smithereens and would be occupying it today. So Afghanistan also violates international law. And since the UN is a signatory country of the UN Charter, because of the Supremacy Clause in the U.S. Constitution, Article 6, Paragraph 2, which states any treaty the U.S. signs, any foreign treaty, becomes the supreme law of our land. So if a soldier agrees to follow an order to deploy to Iraq or Afghanistan, they are violating international law, the U.S. Constitution, and the oath they swore to defend and protect the Constitution, and violating their own Uniform Code of Military Justice. And all of these soldiers understand this, and more soldiers are starting to understand it, and it is thanks in large part to things like the Winter Soldier events.
And as you say, the soldiers are victims too.
Really, people in the military, when we expand the frame enough, are really victims in this whole situation as well. You know, they're not getting treatment. They're being redeployed over and over. They come home to a VA that is not giving them the care they need, all the broken promises from the recruiters. So I really found a lot of common ground with these folks and shared experience. And again, was really, really touched to see, given everything these people had gone through, I mean, some of them having committed a lot of the atrocities themselves, and seeing the spiritual weight they're having to carry around from having done so. And then despite all that, taking it upon themselves to stand up and speak out and talk to journalists and try to get this information out, sometimes at great personal risk, I really just found a lot of deep respect and admiration for these people.
You yourself came back from reporting on these wars with PTSD.
I did, and it's something that I've decided I need to talk about, you know, because we look at the fact that just talking about veterans from both Iraq and Afghanistan, that there was a RAND Corporation report that came out less than 2 years ago that showed of, at that time, the 1.8 million veterans who had cycled through both occupations, we have at least 200,000 have come back with severe depression and or post-traumatic stress disorder. And I think that's a very, very low number, but we're still looking at a staggering number of people coming back with PTSD. And this does include journalists. And I think it's important that all of us who've experienced this, you know, and this doesn't mean there's something wrong with you, because PTSD is really kind of a normal human response to when you put a human being in an extremely abnormally destructive situation, then this is a normal result, that you start shutting down psychologically. You start putting on psychological armor to protect yourself. You have to kind of start shutting down parts of your feelings to just kind of get through this horrific situation. But then the problem is when you come back home and having experienced trauma, whether it's killing people yourself or looking at the dead bodies afterwards as I did, what do you do with this information? What do you do with these memories? And you have to see a counselor. You have to talk to people about it. You have to write about it. And you have to take care of yourself while you go through this process. And this, you know, this is kind of like, you know, one of these dark secrets in the country that nobody really wants to talk about. But I think that we all of us who have been through this, owe it to ourselves and to anybody who will listen to really share openly and candidly, look, this is what it is, and this is what it does to us, and this is what it's doing to our souls and to the soul of our country. And until we're open and honest with this stuff and deal with it publicly, you know, then really, I really don't see how there's going to be a solution.
Dar Jamil, your book is The Will to Resist. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks very much.
Next up, we talk with three writers who will be panelists at this year's Right Angles Conference, a cookbook author, a mystery writer, and a print journalist turned blogger. Stay tuned.
Let me tell you the story of a place without glory in a sandpit they call Iraq, where Abu Zarqawi and his homie jihadis decided to set up shop. The Hadjis in Qaeda were holed up inside the mosques and the booby trap shacks. But the U.S. Marines put a dent in their dreams, and I'm halfway to hell and back.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. For the last 22 years, our region has played host to Right Angles, a terrific writers' conference. I caught up with a few of the panelists to give you a preview. Laura Brody is the best-selling author of 18 cookbooks, among them Growing Up on the Chocolate Diet and The Cape Cod Table. She's even got a cookbook about broccoli, which takes a certain amount of courage. I caught up with her by phone in France's beautiful southwestern region, the Dordogne, where she was leading her annual cooking tour. She started out as a chef and a caterer, but got tired of standing on her feet all day.
And a very wonderful, smart friend of mine said, what you're really good at is sales, and what you need is a product. So I thought, wow, I could make the world's best brownie, or I could, you know. She said, no, don't do anything with shelf life. Write a book where you should hitch your food processor up to your word processor and write down all those stories that you tell. And it was a case of being in the right place at the right time. And my first book, Growing Up on the Chocolate Diet, was the product of that time.
That sounds like a very dangerous book.
It's a memoir, actually. I wrote three memoirs with recipes, and this was before it was really trendy to do that. So it was a special way of writing that I really, really enjoy, and I would love to do more of.
So what is so special about it, and why wouldn't you already have done more of it?
Well, actually, I have a collection of stories in process, but it's very difficult. The cookbook world has changed, and you really need to have a platform, which is a restaurant or a TV show. The publisher needs to know before they buy the book that you have a way of selling it. And as a new author, that's very tough. I think that's one of the things we're going to discuss in the conference, that it's hard to get your foot in the door, and you have to be very creative, and you have to go from being a writer after you write your book to being a salesperson, and not everybody can do that.
So what are some, you know, maybe don't give the whole store away, but what are a couple of suggestions that you would give to people who want to write a cookbook?
I would tell them to think smaller and to start doing magazines, pitch to magazines and newspapers, community newspapers, blogs. I've started doing a blog now. I actually have putting the short stories and the memoirs on a blog and hoping that somebody will read it who will say, wow, I think this should be in a book. It's sort of a tough choice between, are you going to give it away, which you're doing, you know, putting it on the internet, or are you going to try to sell it? Like many, many people, I went to see Julie and Julia. I went with a sort of different take because Julia Child was a friend of mine. And I thought, wow, look at this, what this woman's doing. She's, you know, sort of very creative, and although it really made Julia very angry, I think that she didn't like this woman taking advantage of her name, using her name. It's very, very interesting, the whole dynamics of it. But, you know, maybe go home and think, okay, I have these stories. I want to share them. Nobody's stepping up to publish them right now, but let me get them out there. And that's, I guess, the advice I would give.
Brody tells aspiring cookbook authors, it's not enough just to be a good cook.
First, you have to be a writer. I think you can't just sit down and write a cookbook unless you're a writer first. I think anyone could sit down and make a collection of recipes, but if you can't make it alive by the writing, why would somebody want to read it? One of the things I'm going to talk about is head notes, which is sort of the handshake before the recipe. And if you can't make an introduction to the reader about why they should make this recipe, I think it's going to languish.
You intrigued me when you said that you were a friend of Julia Child. What made her writing so special?
Well, she was doing something that no one else was doing in the beginning, writing about French cooking that Americans could do. But it's that handshake and introduction, and Julia was amazing at it. And this is sort of a digression, but my son Max, who's going to be on the panel with me, who has a restaurant in the Pioneer Valley, he knew Julia as well. And Max and I have written a book together, and I think Max has that unique ability to talk about food in an unpretentious, straightforward, but entertaining way that makes you want to cook. And that's what Julia did.
So do you have an anecdote that you can share with us?
My favorite anecdote with Julia and the boys, the first time Julia came to dinner, we were sitting at the table, and I'd done the Julia rehearsal dinner many, many, many times, and we were in the middle of dinner, and Max was about, I don't know, 8, or maybe he was 6, and our oldest son was 8, and they were busy in the kitchen. They came out, they had chef's hats and aprons, and they were wearing Groucho Marx glasses, you know, with the noses and the bushy eyebrows, and they were holding a huge silver platter on which was a rubber chicken that they had garnished with parsley and cherry tomatoes. And they presented to her, and Julia picks it up. She says, oh, she says, pollo al dente. She said, we can certainly stretch this into quite a meal.
Oh, that's wonderful. And were you scared to serve Julia Child?
Well, I cooked for her before. Her producer, Ruth Lockwood, who was a producer for The French Chef, had invited me or asked me to, or hired me actually, to do a dinner. And I guess she hadn't told me until the very last minute who I was cooking for. And I only had a day to make myself hysterical. But Julia was she's so personable and she was so generous and so curious about you and so easy to be with. Yes, I was nervous, but as soon as she showed up on my doorstep, and we served Niçoise olives, and we were sitting out on the deck, and she popped some in her mouth, and she takes the seeds, and she flings them over her shoulder into the yard, and she says, well, you'll have an olive tree any day now. And you know, it was just that kind of amazing person. I miss her terribly.
A great story by cookbook author Laura Brody. She spoke to us from France, where she's conducting her 12th cooking tour of the Dordogne. By the way, Brody's son Max has taken after her. He's the owner and chef of the Night Kitchen restaurant in Montague, Massachusetts. And yes, he was named after the hero of Where the Wild Things Are. Go to writersvoice.net for two of Laura Brody's holiday baking recipes, Ruggelach and Christmas Stolen. Next, we hear from mystery writer Lisa Kleinholz. She's author of the Zoe Szabo series about a punk rock journalist sleuth in rural New England. Kleinholz started out by wanting to write regular fiction, but found it difficult to sell her first book. So she tried her hand at mystery writing, and her career took off. I asked her if that was because she was a natural at the genre, or it's just easier to sell mysteries.
That's a good question. The reason I wrote a mystery was because I thought it was easier to sell a mystery, and since I was able to sell it and a second follow-up, I guess I was right. I think it's always easier in a genre because there are niches at all the publishers for a certain number of genre books in like either romance or mystery or thriller to be published each year. So they have slots that they need to fill with literary or what people now disparagingly call mainstream novels. There's a lot more leeway, and people have to love it a whole lot more to be able to get it through the whole process of the publication process.
In other words, they know that they can sell mysteries because there are mystery genre aficionados out there. And so
that's right. I think it's one of the better selling fields. I think first is probably romance sells the most books in total, and then mystery, I think, is right behind it.
Now, in terms of writing that first mystery, how did you know how to do it?
The reason I chose mystery rather than some other genre was because I had grown up reading mysteries, Nancy Drew, and I really loved them, and I had started reading the very, I don't know, tough female writers that came around in the, I guess, the late 70s or early 80s. Sue Grafton is the one I think of the most, and I thought, you know, I'd like to try to do that. I can see where I can fit the other ideas that I want to incorporate in my writing, my themes, into this format. And that's why I chose it, because I loved it.
Do you have to be very organized to be a mystery writer? How do you keep all those plot elements in their place, introducing them in such a way that maintains suspense? You must know the end, right, before you begin, if you do mysteries?
Well, it's funny. Since I published my first book, I've been on lots and lots of panels with lots of million mystery writers, from very unknown, obscure people to very famous ones, and everybody has a different method. There are the people who work with a very strict outline, an outline that can be 100 pages long, and there are people who have no idea when they put that first sentence down what the next sentence is going to be or where they're going to end up. I would say probably the majority of people start out with a vague idea of where they're going and perhaps an endpoint, maybe not knowing exactly who the murderer is, but having a feeling about it'll be either one of these two people. And then they'll go along writing a draft and it will solve itself. Some people never rewrite. Other people like me, I rewrite constantly.
And are you the kind of person who has an outline pretty well fixed in mind, or do you develop it as you go?
Yes, both. I write a first draft pretty much off the top of my head, and I just try to get through it as quickly as possible. I say it's a quick and dirty first draft, and then I really know what elements are going to work for me, what characters are going to work for me. Then I know who my murderer is, and then I go back and write an outline and figure out what elements that are in that first draft are just going to disappear and which ones are going to be expanded. And because the genre has a fairly set formula for certain conventions in terms of the pacing of the book and the arcs, it's pretty easy to go back on that second draft and really have a very strong outline.
One thing I've thought about often, because I love mysteries, and, you know, there's a certain suspension of morality, I think, that you have to do to love a mystery. I mean, mysteries are fun, but they're about murder. They're about things that really aren't fun at all, in fact, are terrible and evil. Why do we have so much fun with mysteries?
I guess there's been a lot theoretical written about this very question. I haven't read all those theories, but it seems to me that there is a question of the orderly world being completely disrupted and overturned, and the detective goes through and applies logic and brings the world back to order. So I think it can be satisfying on that level. Then, of course, there's the rubbernecking at the highway accident level. And there are so many different subgenres in mystery crime that they run the gamut from, you know, cozies with cats to serial killers and hitmen who have the hero of the book.
Or medical examiners.
Yeah, yeah. There's all kinds of grisly stuff.
I learned way more than I ever thought I wanted to know about medical examining by reading Patricia Cornwell.
Yeah, Patricia Cornwell, yeah. I used to read her books, and then they suddenly got too grisly for me. Yeah.
So what are your themes? What are the things that really excite you about applying to this genre of mystery?
Well, my books take place in a small college town, somewhat like Amherst, but not called Amherst. It's called Greymont. And I think I got interested in my first book. I had been writing for a local newspaper, and I worked on a series of stories about Cambodian refugees and the terrible problems that they had gone through in Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge and their attempt to get their lives back in order here, and the dislocation and of the difficulty of coming from such a different culture and trying to adjust to America. And so those social issues and the issues of global influences on small-town American life just fascinate me. So the murder is, for me, sometimes an excuse to delve into social issues.
You can read excerpts from Lisa Kleinholz's books, Exiles on Main Street and Dancing with Mr. D, at writersvoice.net. Our last Right Angles Conference panelist is UMass journalism professor B.J. Roche. She started her career a long time ago at the UMass student paper, The Daily Collegian. She went on to be a weekly newspaper editor in Amherst, then a correspondent and columnist for the Boston Globe. We invited her on to talk about online publishing. She's teaching a course on blogging this semester. B.J. Roche's own blog, 50shift.com, is for, by, and about women over 40. She says a lot of women are publishing online these days.
Women over 40, midlife women, are the fastest growing group of people getting into things like social media. For example, Facebook, the biggest Facebook growth in the last few years has been among women over the age of 35. So I think people, there's sort of the sense that women, older women, aren't really doing technology, and that's just not true. Everybody is online now. It's just so easy now to get something up online. The content management systems are very user-friendly. The technology is easy. It's not that expensive to get something up and running. And I sort of saw a need for a place where women of a certain age could kind of share information, essays, humor, that didn't involve necessarily, you know, having five-year-olds in your house. Sort of looking at the topics that we all kind of talk about when we get together for a glass of wine. Taking care of your elderly parents is a big issue. There's not a lot out there on that. Taking care of cranky teenagers. I mean, all of the parenting magazines, they all sort of end at, I think, about like age 12. There's a reason for that, you know. It's not pretty dealing with teenagers. One of the ways that I kind of summed it up was at a point in my life, there was one week where I was taking my daughter for her learner's permit, and a few days later on the phone with my sister about how we were going to take the keys away from my mother because she was starting to get to be too old to drive. And I thought, this is kind of an interesting age to be at. You know, maybe there are some things that we could talk about, and that's what we do.
That is fascinating. And how is your website doing?
Well, it's been a real education because it's one thing to have things to say, but it's quite another to try to get an audience. And that's really the big challenge, I think, with online publishing that people don't really realize until you're into the thick of it. You know, you need to invest time, you need to invest money. It's a lot like having a baby. It needs to be fed every 4 hours or people don't come back. There are so many sites out there that getting the traffic and getting people to know about you is kind of a challenge.
Well, this is something I do a lot of thinking about because Writer's Voice has is a blog as well as a podcast, and my webmaster is I don't think of him as a webmaster so much as a taskmaster. He is always telling me I need to tweet twice a day and when's the best time to tweet, and he analyzes the statistics. He's a genius on SEO, search engine optimization. He insists that I send him text that he then will tweak for optimal search engine optimization. And sometimes he comes up with titles that I find strange, but they must be good because the web traffic is definitely increasing.
Oh, absolutely. No, that's what it's – there is a real – well, you know, it's funny. There is a science to it, but in some ways it just feels so cheesy to be rearranging your beautifully – hard slaved over words and then to throw something in because it's going to show up on the search engine. And so I don't know quite how to get around that. When I first came up with the name for the site, for example, I wanted something that kind of conveyed moving into that next decade and moving into the second half. But now what happens with that, now that I have the Google AdSense, because I have the word shift in it, I get all these ads for, you know, manual transmission renovations. So it really is. I did a blog post at one point called The Tyranny of the Search Engine, and I think that really is true. But your thing about the tweeting, you know, there are ways that you can sort of get your site out there on other people's sites, for example, by posting a nice comment and then having a link back to your site. We post all of our new content onto our Facebook pages with links, and that really has turned out to be the biggest traffic generator for us, is that people click over to the site from a post on a Facebook page. I mean, it's amazing. We have one of our writers, Helene Powers, who's a really beautiful writer. She did a book that we actually published, a little booklet on caring for, it's called Friends Indeed, How to Help During a Serious Illness, on caring, how to help people who are caring for people with a serious illness. She posted a comment on the New York Times Well blog about something relating to one of the posts there. And we got 100 clicks back from people who had clicked over from that Well blog. So this idea of link journalism and linking, you know, putting links out, links in, that's really the way that you have to kind of build your audience.
You say a little bit more about that, because I mean, I have known for a long time that you should kind of post on other blogs in a way that doesn't toot your horn too loudly, but does get people to link back to you. But I find it difficult. First of all, how do you know what blogs to go and post on?
Well, you know, this is the troubling thing. And when you talk about the difference between online publishing and the old sort of traditional journalism, I mean, every day I kind of look at this. In the old days, you know, you were the fly on the wall. You didn't put yourself out there. You tried to stay as far out of your story and be the objective observer. This kind of writing is very different because people expect more of you, maybe even more than you might be comfortable sharing. I mean, and that's a different thing. Also, the degree of self-promotion that you have to do is pretty, you know, in some ways it's kind of abhorrent to a lot of us. It just feels aggressive. It just doesn't feel right. But you need to get over that because that's really what you have to do. I think what the key is on posting on other people's blogs is that if you're adding value, if you're adding new information, or you're adding a reference, or you're adding something that kind of adds to the conversation instead of just being, oh, yeah, I just read about this over at this site, go over there. I think that is sort of, you know, there's sort of an etiquette to doing this, that you bring value rather than you know, just a link to your site.
And how do you find the right kind of blogs to post on?
Yeah, well, like, for example, we did, on my site, we do sort of a mix of aggregation and original content. So I did a piece on bone health where I wrote about a book on bone. I had a bone density test that I was kind of shocked because I think of myself as healthy, but, you know, the doctor said, well, your bones are, you know, you need some to be doing calcium, blah, blah, blah. So I did a little story on this, on bone health and what contributes to good bone health, why women's bones get, you know, I'm just a piece of journalism on this. There's a site that we have an RSS feed from called Women's Health, where the woman had written a story on bone density scans. So I posted a comment that said, you know, I was surprised to find that I think of myself as healthy, but I had weak bones. I've done some research on this. Take a look. So I didn't really repeat the information that she had, but I was adding to it with mine. And she has since linked over to my site from her site. So now I'm on her blog roll.
And how did you find her? Or I guess what I'm asking is, what do you do to find the kinds of blogs that you would like to comment on?
Okay, there's some great ways to do this now. There's a really great site called alltop.com. It's like an aggregation site based on topics of blogs, but it's selective. They don't take everyone. I mean, they have lots and lots and lots of people on it, but they do sort of screen for kind of the best blogs that are out there. So what Alltop does is it aggregates blogs based on topics. So you can go into alltop.com, as I did, for example, and I searched for this term midlife women or baby boomer women, and you find, you know, maybe 30 or 40 blogs up there. You look at the different ones. Those ones you link to, those are the ones that you kind of, partner with. The other interesting thing, too, I think, when we talk about the differences, when you think about quote-unquote competition, it's not, competition isn't really competition. These are people who are sort of like-minded. You want to link with these people because they can send you people and you send them people. There's a couple of women down in Texas who do this thing called, they're called the Midlife Gals, and they do these very funny videos. So they found us on Alltop, and now they've linked to us, and we're linking to them. So competition can actually sort of help you build your audience.
Now, all this takes an enormous amount of time, none of which is paid. And this is, of course, both the advantage in a way of the internet and advantage in the sense that, without the internet, many people could never have had the careers they've been able to have. I mean, without the internet, Writer's Voice would not have the audience that it has. I mean, we're nationally syndicated in terms of radio stations, but we have many, many listeners, and many people can listen to our shows years after they first broadcast because of the internet. So that's wonderful, and there were no price barriers to entry as there would have been otherwise. On the other hand, we don't make any money from Writer's Voice. So you teach a course on entrepreneurship using some of these mm-hmm. ideas. Hit on some of the main points, do's and don'ts around making money.
Oh, well, if I had that figured out, I would be on Easy Street by now. I was just out at the Online News Association conference out in San Francisco in early October. And what's interesting now that wasn't even happening maybe even a couple of years ago is there are sort of these models that are starting to emerge for online publications. And, they're not making a killing, but there are different models. For example, some sites now, and in fact, your site might be a good candidate for this, are sort of adopting the public radio model where people they become, quote-unquote members of this association for this site. There's a journalism site called MinPost.com out in Minneapolis that's an online news organization, and they get a good deal of their revenues from membership like that. There's a lot of now sort of philanthropy aimed at journalism now that didn't exist even maybe 10 years ago. People are donating to journalistic projects the way that they would donate to, say, environmental groups like, the Sierra Club. There's a site called Spot US, which is writers develop story ideas and they post it and people can donate $50, $20 to get to, to whatever kind of fund, money they need, $500, $700 to pay a reporter to do a particular story. So things are starting to kind of gel in terms of the financing. But I mean, I think a lot of people are kind of exploring this and trying to figure out what's going to work and what doesn't.
Journalist and blogger BJ Roche. You can get a copy of the booklet Friends Indeed at 50shift.com. Just follow the link from writersvoice.net. BJ Roche, Lisa Kleinholz, and Laura Brody will be speaking on their respective genre panels at the Right Angles Conference at Mount Holyoke College, November 21st. Go to rightanglesconference.org for more information. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. This show was produced with help from intern Amber Bowles. You can hear this and past episodes by going to writersvoice.net. And follow us on Twitter and Facebook to get inside information, news tips on former guests, and info about future ones. Thanks for listening. I'm host Francesca Rhiannon.